Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Hello and welcome to Stick Together, Australia's only national radio show all about workers' rights and social justice. Stick Together is produced at 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne and broadcast across the country on the Community Radio Network. I'm Diana Beaumont. Later in today's show, we're going to hear about the controversial practice of income management, a Centrelink program introduced in trial sites across the country that gives people a portion of their Centrelink payments in a card that can only be used to buy certain goods in certain stores. The interim report of the McClure Review into the welfare system has recommended the expansion of the income management program. So today we'll speak to David Tennant, the CEO of Family Care in Shepparton, whose clients have been subjected to income management as part of the trial.
It's very hard to get a cumulative total of the resource that has been spent on income management, but it's certainly north of $1 billion so far, so we are not talking a small investment.
But more from David later in the program. In our first story today, we consider another angle on the budget debate. The federal government always talks about the need to rein in excessive government expenditure. But how often do we hear the budget deficit framed in terms of insufficient income? And I'm not even referring to increasing taxes, rather simply stopping companies and wealthy individuals from avoiding tax that they owe to the government. A crackdown on tax avoidance would allow the government to fund social services, a health system, and welfare programs to ensure every Australian of a dignified existence. Now, the issue of taxation is extremely complex and can be a bit dry. So today we're going to try and make it as interesting and as accessible as possible. We're joined by Mark Zernsack, who's Director of the Justice and International Mission from the Uniting Church in Victoria and Tasmania. And he's also involved in the Tax Justice Project, which has a range of resources available on its website at taxjustice.org.au. Mark and I are going to unpack some of the ways that companies and high wealth individuals dodge tax and what can be done about it. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Can you tell us about some of the grossest and most blatant examples of tax avoidance here in Australia?
The ones that the Australian Tax Office has referred to, they're seeing a growing trend where a multinational company has set up what they call a marketing hub, and they'll normally locate that in somewhere like Singapore or Ireland, and then that hub will provide them with a service, and the company here will pay a return on that service. So let's say it's a marketing service, but they've seen companies paying returns on that service of 900%. So, which is, you know, a massive markup in order to shift profit offshore into a place like Singapore or Ireland that has a much lower corporate tax rate than here in Australia. The other ones that we're aware of that both the previous government and the current government are moving to crack down on is artificial debt loading. So this is where a multinational company loads up its subsidiary here in Australia with a whole lot of debt, which is purposely constructed solely for the purpose of then being able to make interest-free payments back to a subsidiary, normally in a tax haven or better known as a secrecy jurisdiction, in order to claim that interest repayment as a tax deduction off their profits that they would make here and otherwise be taxed here for doing so.
Yeah, well, the Sydney Morning Herald reported just recently that Australia's largest coal miner, Glencore, paid almost zero tax over the past 3 years despite earning income of $15 billion. And that was something to do with debt loading, was it not? Is that the issue that you're talking about just now?
Indeed. So there were allegations. They used a range, the allegations certainly in the press were of a range of tax dodging activities that Glencore had used, and certainly this is not the first. We're certainly not the first country that's that where allegations against Glencore have been made. There had been previously, the Norwegian government had funded a auditor to look at a subsidiary of Glencore and the Canadian company First Quantum that operated in Zambia. And the finding of the auditor in that case was that the Glencore subsidiary may have avoided paying tax on $700 million worth of income, was the allegation that that was made in that case.
Well, meanwhile, in Australia, the University of Technology Sydney revealed in a study they did that the Westfield Group that owns the shopping centre chains has paid an effective tax rate of only 8% over the last 9 years. Can you talk about that example?
So that was work that was commissioned actually by United Voice, the trade union, and to have a comeback of an effective tax rate of 8% certainly indicates Westfield should have a lot of explaining to do as to why that ends up being its effective tax rate by those measures that were used in that study. And certainly given that United Voice has also funded research that has shown that Westfield has tax dodged in the US and UK, it does call into question around their tax-paying activities here in Australia as well.
What practical policy solutions are already in mainstream debate that would generate significant tax revenue for the government? Maybe we could step through them one by one in the Australian context. I mean, the first area might be superannuation. You know, the Australia Institute estimates that the federal budget would be more than $13 billion better off if they scrapped the tax breaks that are currently on superannuation. Can you talk about how the current superannuation arrangements benefit the wealthy?
This isn't so much an issue of, in this case, this isn't a tax dodging issue. This is simply that the arrangements around superannuation in terms of the tax have benefited the wealthy. So obviously there is a flat 15% tax on contributions paid to superannuation, which means effectively those on high incomes get a tax discount. Those on very low incomes, obviously it's actually a disadvantage to pay into superannuation.
What about another area of intense debate over recent years, and that's the mining tax? How much could the mining tax proposed under the previous Labor government have generated?
Look, certainly a well-designed tax could again have generated in the billions of dollars as an alternative way of collecting taxes. And certainly the aim here was very much based on a very solid notion that the mining resources are a non-renewable resource and, you know, you only get to mine them and sell them once. So there's an issue of how much of that wealth from digging up those resources and selling them should flow to the greater community and how much should go into the pockets of the mining companies.
But how was it that the initial proposed law got watered down to such an extent that it generated almost no revenue whatsoever?
Well, obviously the mining companies ran a very effective public campaign, and that was quite surprising. I think the previous government sort of simply expected that this would not be sort of contested, that to sort of introduce a tax on super profits would not would be welcomed by the community, and instead they were outmaneuvered, I guess, by a mining industry, cashed up mining industry, willing to spend a lot of money on a slick media campaign that persuaded people that it was in their best interest that the mining companies got to keep their super profits, and somehow we all benefit.
And while it's not illegal, you could say it's a form of tax avoidance when very large and cashed up corporate entities lobby to defeat legislation that a democratically elected government is trying to introduce that would inconveniently increase their tax burden.
Look, I think in a democratic society, you would hope that all people have a sort of equal say. I mean, that is the notion of democratic society, but obviously we have great difficulty, particularly in our system, of stopping cashed up both individuals and corporations from being able to use their cash to exert greater pressure over government policy and direction than the ordinary person in the street.
We're speaking to Mark Zernsack, who's from the Tax Justice Project and works with the Justice and International Mission with the Uniting Church in Victoria and Tasmania. Mark, I wanted to ask, do you support the idea of a tax on financial transactions, otherwise known as a Tobin tax? That's a campaign that's been going on internationally for years, but is it any closer to being realised?
The 11 European countries have agreed to a financial transaction tax, and to be honest, there are other countries that have versions of this in terms of stamp duty payments on financial transactions. So look, it is a there are two arguments around this: one, whether a kind of tax on the sort of stock market speculation trades is one of benefit in terms of revenue raising, and then two, whether it also has other benefits such as curbing the amount of speculative trading that goes on, and the very high volume trading where, you know, shares are bought and sold in milliseconds by programs, computer programs that are set up to do all this sort of trading. So there's both an argument about whether it raises revenue and also whether it adds more stability into the market system by curbing that. And certainly the French experience has been that they actually collected less revenue than initially was anticipated because of that dampening effect it had on speculative trading within the market system. So there are, you know, certainly merits to that kind of tax being applied, but here in Australia it seems unlikely we'd see movement, unfortunately, on that, given both major parties have indicated they're not supportive of the introduction of such a tax.
Well, in the face of serious cuts to social spending in Australia, I think we urgently need to get this issue of tax back on the agenda. What do you think should be the government's priority in terms of increasing its revenue and facilitate, you know, proper substantial spending on social programs?
Oh, look, I think if you were talking tax reform, then I really do think the government needs to be looking at greater equity in the way taxes are raised, and that means a more progressive tax system. So, and you've already raised with me the issue, for example, of looking at the inequities within the way superannuation is taxed. There are also certain benefits around capital gains tax. There were changes made under the Howard government that, again, largely favour the wealthy. We also, negative gearing in the housing market is another big area that gets raised on a regular basis. And certainly the combination of both the brakes on capital gains tax and negative gearing, again, generally favour those who are better off. So I think if you were looking at a more equitable society, you would be looking at how can we do some rebalancing. And certainly, you know, one of the big issues then we face both within Australia and also globally is rising inequality. So we're going through a period where, because of this lowering of taxes, particularly at the top end of town, both in terms of top marginal tax rates and corporate tax rates keep being lowered, even in this last budget, despite all the cuts made to services, the government chose to forego more revenue by reducing the corporate tax rate from 30% down to 28.5% as the corporate tax rate. So that's leading to greater inequality, and greater inequality is leading to more social problems, both domestically and globally. So I think we need to be looking at reversing those issues of inequality through a more equitable tax system. But in terms of plugging the holes, which is where we started, there are efforts now being made between, for example, tax authorities moving to automatically exchange information with each other as a way of making clear where both corporates and wealthy individuals are shifting, trying to engage in games of shifting money around to avoid paying tax in the places where they're actually doing business and where they should be paying their taxes. So that's been a big step forward in terms of curbing this type of activity. There's also a lot of pressure now to see disclosure on shell companies and hidden corporate structures that try to hide the identity of people, again, for purposes of both tax evasion but also other sorts of illicit activities. We're starting to see movement on that. The United Kingdom has announced they're introducing a public registry of company ownership. So that's another area. And certainly, again, the tax office has said that they've seen hundreds of Australians using shell companies to try and hide their identity and engage in tax evasion and tax avoidance. So it's an area well worth cracking down on.
Indeed. Well, it's a complicated area, but it's good that groups like the Tax Justice Project are keeping the spotlight on it. Mark Czernczak is with the Tax Justice Project, and he's also director with the Justice and International Mission from the Uniting Church in Victoria and Tasmania. Mark, thanks so much for joining us on Stick Together.
Thanks for the opportunity.
You're listening to Stick Together, all about workers' rights and social justice.
Every week on the Community Radio Network.
Want to support 3CR's diverse and independent voices? Well, it's not too late, and we still need your support. Donate now by calling 9419 8377. Or donate online at www.3cr.org.au or post us a cheque or money order to Post Office Box 1277, Collingwood 3066.
The McClure Review of the Welfare System has just issued its interim report, which recommends the expansion of income management, which is the practice of giving people a portion of their Centrelink payments in a card that can only be used to buy certain goods. Income management was originally used in Aboriginal communities as part of the Northern Territory intervention, but it's also been trialled more broadly in Shepparton in Victoria, in Logan and Rockhampton in Queensland, in Playford in Outer Adelaide, and in Bankstown in Sydney. And according to the Australian newspaper, almost 24,000 people across the country are now subjected to income management, about 20,000 of whom are in the Northern Territory. The Federal Social Services Minister, Kevin Andrews, describes income management as a success and says he's considering broader application across the country. Today we're joined by David Tennant, who's CEO of Family Care in Shepparton, whose clients have been subjected to income management as part of this national trial. And he's joining us today to talk more about his clients' experience and about his agency's view of the income management program. David, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Diana.
So first explain for us which groups of Centrelink recipients get put on income management in the Shepparton region at present, and is it voluntary or compulsory?
Well, in the early stages, from July 2011 when the program started, the majority of people who were involved in income management in Shepparton were volunteers. There existed two compulsory measures. One was for those who were identified by Centrelink social workers as being vulnerable, where there was an option for them to be referred compulsorily for income management. And the second group were those who were identified by child protection workers as requiring income management. That was similar in some ways to a program that had operated in Western Australia previously. But we were quite pleased that the Victorian government rejected the invitation from the Commonwealth to take up that compulsory measure, and those that were child protection referees needed to consent to the process. So in effect, it became another voluntary measure.
And which categories of Centrelink recipients participated in the income management program in Shepparton?
Well, pretty much anybody who received a benefit income could take up the option to be a volunteer for the program. And in a sense, the great division that exists in income management is that distinction between those who volunteer to participate because they think it might be a useful mechanism for them to budget and make the most effective use of a limited income, and those who are compulsorily referred. And I guess the one message that stood out above all others for us here in Shepparton, but also those in the other four trial sites, was that there weren't very many people who took up that option. And in fact, in response to that, the previous government decided that another group, those receiving a series of youth benefits, would be compulsorily referred regardless of whether they had any need for income management, just because they were receiving a particular type of benefit. And the majority of those were young people who were receiving the unreasonable to live at home allowance.
And can you outline for us the concerns that your agency, Family Care in Shepparton, has about compulsory income management? How does it impact on people? And how does it, you know, limit how they can, you know, manage the scarce resources they have?
Well, the most significant impact of compulsory income management for people who either don't want it or don't need it is that it takes away that fundamental choice to be able to use your income and apply it as you would see fit. Now, that's not to say that some people don't apply those funds in ways that that the general community might object to, or even that the government might object to. But it's that idea of agency where you get to make your own choices, even if those choices aren't the best for you or your family. When people are compulsorily referred, they lose that fundamental right, and mostly our experience is they're pretty disappointed by that. And in fact, all of the evaluation material to date, both in the Northern Territory and in other places, suggests that the worst of outcomes and the worst impressions amongst people who are participants are for those who've been compulsorily referred, precisely because they lose that ability to choose.
And it's fairly undignified, isn't it? They have to present at their local store with a basics card that announces to the world that they are on benefits and they are having their income managed by Centrelink.
Yeah, there's been a consistent theme of criticism about the basics card in the way that it identifies people so clearly and publicly as those involved in income management. And it's produced considerable stigma, and again, that's a finding that is consistent across most of the evaluations.
Is there also an issue with travel? For example, if someone is on income management in Shepparton and they have a portion of their income quarantined onto the basics card, what do they do if they come to Melbourne, for example?
Well, the short answer is struggle. What they need to be conscious of is finding retailers and providers who will accept the basics card, and many don't. And, you know, often the moments where you need that are, you know, say pulling into a service station where you need to fuel your car up and you find that that particular station outlet doesn't accept the basics card. Well, if you're just about out of fuel, that's not very helpful. And even though you may have your non-income managed funds to draw from, because we're talking about very small sums of money and then the division of those ever smaller sums of money, it becomes an increasingly difficult exercise for people to budget at that micro level. And my experience of working with people on low incomes over a very long period of time is actually they're pretty good at budgeting. So if the Commonwealth is intending to give them a tool that makes that easier, it's kind of ironic that in many instances it makes it harder.
We're speaking to David Tennant, who's CEO of Family Care in Shepparton. David, do you expect that income management will be rolled out on a compulsory basis to Centrelink recipients across the country? As we mentioned in our introduction, the Federal Social Services Minister, Kevin Andrews, is certainly talking about expanding the program further.
Look, I think the most disappointing part of the way that this debate and discussion of income management has evolved now over a number of years, it's almost as if, as we've invested as a country more and more money in building the infrastructure, we've lost the will to actually analyse what the data we have been able to collect is telling us. And I read in the interim McClure report broad sweeping conclusions that the evaluations are positive. Well, in fact, when you read those evaluations, and the best of them, rather than those that were done internally to government, they say anything but, you know, a positive picture, or certainly one that's consistent. There are lots of negative experiences that people have had, and the most negative of those experiences have been in relation to compulsory income management.
Is income management expensive to administer?
Absolutely. It's very hard to get a cumulative total of the resource that has been spent on income management. but it's certainly north of $1 billion so far. So we are not talking a small investment.
$1 billion simply to issue Centrelink recipients with a basics card and direct the way that they spend their money. That's not $1 billion given to people through Centrelink. That's only in administration?
It is. And look, it would be wrong to say that income management is only the basics card. At its best, it can be a genuine opportunity for people on low incomes to engage in a more fulsome way with how they use their money. The problem is that many of the advantageous other programs like financial counselling are not properly connected to income management, and all of our sunk investment is in infrastructure like building card reading kiosks for the basics card, where a much simpler, more straightforward and ultimately cheaper option would have been building it into the existing banking system. And I note that Andrew Forrest, a report I don't believe that's publicly available yet, but my understanding is that his review of Indigenous policy says similar things about the basics card.
Well, David Tennant, CEO of Family Care in Shepparton, thanks for joining us today to give us this grassroots direct account of how income management has been experienced by people in Shepparton.
That's a pleasure.
And that's all we have time for on Stick Together, your weekly program about the struggles for the dignity of people both in and out of paid employment. If you enjoyed the show, then keep in touch with us by liking the Stick Together page on Facebook or subscribing to our podcast via the 3CR radio website. That's www.3cr.org.au. Thanks to the Community Broadcasting Foundation for its financial support of the program. I'm Diana Beaumont. Thanks for listening, and do tune in again at the same time next week. But I'll take you out with a track today, Hold That Line by Peter Hicks.
Hold that line, sisters, brothers, never weaken, stand and hold that picket line. Hold that line, hold that line, sisters, brothers, never weaken, stand and hold that picket line. Oh, we're standing here together, one for all and all for one, and we'll keep right on air standing till our victory we have won. Well, you know.